7. Social horror films. We've already discussed a few films with social implications. Pimples and the heartbreak of psoriasis in the 50s, not to mention Michael Landon drooling shaving cream all over his high school jacket. But there have been other films which tackle more serious social subjects. In some cases, Rollerball, Wild in the Streets. These films feature a logical or satirical extrapolation of current social trends and thus become science fiction. We'll restrict these, if you don't mind, on the grounds that they constitute another dance, a bit different from this dark cotillion we're currently engaged in. There have been a few films which have tried to walk the borderline between horror and social satire. One of those which seems to me to tread this borderline most successfully is The Stepford Wives. The film is based on the novel by Ira Levin, and Levin has actually been able to pull this difficult trick off twice, the other case being that of Rosemary's Baby, which we'll talk about in some depth when we finally arrive at our discussion of the horror novel. For now, we'll stick to The Stepford Wives, which has some witty things to say about women's liberation and some disquieting things to say about the American male's response to it. I spent some time trying to decide if the film, directed by Brian Forbes and starring Catherine Ross and Paula Prentice, really belonged in this book. It is as satiric as the best of Kubrick's work, although a good deal less elegant, and I defy an audience not to laugh when Ross and Prentice step into the home of a neighbor. He's the local druggist and a Walter Mitty type if ever there was one, and hear his wife moaning upstairs. "Oh, Frank, you're the greatest. Frank, you're the best. You're the champ." But the credit for this particular scene belongs to neither Forbes nor Levin, but with the film's screenwriter, William Goldman, who was a very funny fellow. If you doubt, see his wonderful send-up of fantasy and fairy tales, The Princess Bride. I can think of no other satire, with the possible exception of Alice in Wonderland, which is so clearly an expression of love and humor and good temper. The original Levin story avoided the label horror novel, something like the label pariah dog in the more exalted circles of literary criticism, because most critics saw it as Levin's sly poke at the women's movement. But the scarier implications of Levin's jape are not directed at women at all. They are aimed unerringly at those men who consider it only their due to leave for the golf course on Saturday morning after breakfast has been served them, and to reappear, loaded more likely than not, in time for their dinner to be served them. I'm including it here, as social horror rather than social satire, because the film, after some uneasy backing and filling where it seems unsure of just what it does want to be, becomes just that. A social horror story. Catherine Ross and her husband, played by Peter Masterson, move from New York City to Stepford, a Connecticut suburb, because they feel it will be better for the children and themselves as well. Stepford is a perfect little village, where kids wait good-humoredly for the school bus, where you can see two or three fellows washing their cars on any given day, where you feel the yearly United Fund quota is not only met, but exceeded. Yet there's a strangeness in Stepford. A lot of the wives seem a little, well, spacey. Pretty, always attired in flowing dresses that are almost gowns, a place where the movie slips, I think, as a labeling device is pretty crude. These women might as well be wearing stickers pasted to their foreheads which read, "I am one of the weird Stepford wives." They all drive station wagons, discuss housework with an inordinate degree of enthusiasm, and seem to spend any spare time at the supermarket. One of the Stepford wives, one of the weird ones, cracks her head in a minor parking lot fender bender. Later we see her at a lawn party repeating over and over again, "I simply must get that recipe. I simply must get that recipe. I simply must." The secret of Stepford comes clear immediately. Freud, in a tone which sounds suspiciously like despair, asked, "Woman, what does she want?" Forbes and company ask the opposite question and come up with a stinging answer. Men, the film says, do not want women. They want robots with sex organs. There are several funny scenes in the movie, besides the aforementioned Frank, you're the champ sequence. My own favorite comes when, at a women's bitch session Ross and Prentice have arranged, the weird Stepford wives begin discussing cleaning products and laundry soaps with a slow and yet earnest intensity. Everyone seems to have walked right out of one of those commercials male Madison Avenue execs sometimes refer to as two C's in a K, meaning two cunts in a kitchen. But the movie waltzes slowly out of this brightly lit room of social satire and into a darker chamber by far. We feel the ring closing, first around Paula Prentice, then around Catherine Ross. There is an uncomfortable passage when the artist, who apparently creates the feature for the robots, sits sketching Ross, his eyes looking up from the sketch pad at her and then back down again. There is the smirking expression on the face of Tina Louise's husband as the bulldozer rips up the surface of her tennis court in preparation for the pool he always wanted. There is Ross discovering her husband sitting alone in the living room of their new house, a drink in his hand, weeping. She is deeply concerned, but we know that his shallow tears mean only that he has sold her out for a dummy with microchips in her head. Very soon, she will lose all her interest in photography. The movie reserves its ultimate horror and its most telling social shot for the closing moments of the film, when the new Catherine Ross walks in on the old one, perhaps, we think, to murder her. Under her flowing negligee, which might have come from Fredericks of Hollywood, we see Ms. Ross's rather small breasts built up to the size of what men discussing women over beers sometimes refer to as knockers. And, of course, they are no longer the woman's breasts at all. They now belong solely to her husband. The dummy is not quite complete, however. There are two horrible black pools where the eyes should be. Bad enough, and more spectacular, probably, but it was the import of those silicone-swollen breasts that chilled me. The best social horror movies achieve their effect by implication, and the Stepford Wives, by showing us only the surface of things and never troubling to explain exactly how these things are done, implies plenty. I'll not bore you by rehashing the plot of William Friedkin's The Exorcist, another film which relies on the unease generated by changing mores. I'll simply assume that if your interest in the genre has been sufficient to sustain you this far, then you've probably seen it. If the late 50s and early 60s were the curtain raiser on the generation gap, is it a boy or a girl, etc., 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 then the 7 years from 1966 to 1972 were the play itself. Little Richard, who had horrified parents in 1957 when he leapt atop his piano and began boogieing on it in his lizard-skin loafers, looked tame next to John Lennon, who was proclaiming that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus, a statement that set off a rash of fundamentalist record burnings. The Brill Cream look was replaced by those long locks already discussed. Parents began to find strange herbs in their sons' and daughters' bureau drawers. The images in rock music had become increasingly distressing. Mr. Tambourine Man seemed to be about drugs. With the Birds 8 miles high, there could be no question. Radio stations continued to play discs by one group even after two male band members announced they were in love with each other. Elton John proclaimed his AC/DC sexual proclivities and continued successful. Yet less than 20 years before, wild man Jerry Lee Lewis was blackballed from AM airplay when he married his 14-year-old cousin. Then there was the war in Vietnam. Messrs. Johnson and Nixon spread it out like a great big rancid picnic lunch over there in Asia. Many of the young elected not to attend. I got no quarrel with them Kongs, Muhammad Ali announced, and was stripped of his boxing title for declining to take off his gloves and pick up an M1. Kids began burning their draft cards, running away to Canada or Sweden, and marching with Viet Cong flags. In Bangor, where I hung out in my college days, a young man was arrested and incarcerated for replacing the seat of his Levi's with an American flag. Some fun, huh, kid? It was more than a generation gap. The two generations seemed like the San Andreas Fault to be moving along opposing plates of social and cultural conscience, commitment, and definitions of civilized behavior itself. The result was not so much an earthquake as it was a timequake. And with all of this young versus old nuttiness as a backdrop, Friedkin's film of The Exorcist appeared and became a social phenomenon in itself. Lines stretched around the block in every major city where it played, and even in towns which normally rolled up their sidewalks promptly at 7:30 p.m., midnight shows were scheduled. Church groups picketed. Sociologists with pipes pontificated. Newscasters did back-of-the-book segments for their programs on slow nights. The country, in fact, went on a 2-month possession jag. The movie and the novel is nominally about the attempts of two priests to cast a demon out of young Regan McNeil, a pretty little sub-teen played by Linda Blair, who later went on to a high noon showdown with a bathroom plunger in the infamous NBC movie Born Innocent. Substantively, however, it is a film about explosive social change, a finely honed focusing point for that entire youth explosion that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. It was a movie for all those parents who felt, in a kind of agony and terror, that they were losing their children and could not understand why or how it was happening. It's the face of the werewolf again, a Jekyll and Hyde tale in which sweet, lovely, and loving Regan turns into a foul, talking monster strapped into her bed and croaking, in the voice of Mercedes McCambridge, such charming homilies as, "You're going to let Jesus fuck you, fuck you, fuck you." Religious trappings aside, every adult in America understood what the film's powerful subtext was saying. They understood that the demon in Regan McNeil would have responded enthusiastically to the fish cheer in Woodstock. A Warner Brothers executive told me recently that movie surveys show the average filmgoer to be 15 years of age, which may be the biggest reason why the movies so often seem afflicted with a terminal case of arrested development. For every film, like Julia or The Turning Point, there are a dozen like Roller Boogie, and If You Don't Stop It, You'll Go Blind. But it is worth noting that when the infrequent blockbusters, which every film producer hopes for, finally comes along, pictures like Star Wars, Jaws, American Graffiti, The Godfather, Gone with the Wind, and of course, The Exorcist, they always break the demographic hammerlock, which is the enemy of intelligent filmmaking. It is comparatively rare for horror movies to do this, but The Exorcist is a case in point. And we have already spoken of the Amityville Horror, another film which has enjoyed a surprisingly old audience. A film which appealed directly to the 15-year-olds that provide the spike point for movie-going audiences, and one with a subtext tailored to match, was the Brian De Palma adaptation of my novel Carrie. While I believe that both the book and the film depend on largely the same social situations to provide a text and subtext of horror, there's maybe enough difference to make a few interesting observations on De Palma's film version. Both novel and movie have a pleasant high school confidential feel. And while there are some superficial changes from the book and the film, Carrie's mother, for instance, seems to be presented in the film as a kind of weird renegade Roman Catholic, the basic story skeleton is pretty much the same. The story deals with a girl named Carrie White, the brow-beaten daughter of a religious fanatic. Because of her strange clothes and shy mannerisms, Carrie is the butt of every class joke, the social outsider in every situation. She also has a mild telekinetic ability which intensifies after her first menstrual period, and she finally uses this power to bring down the house following a terrible social disaster at her high school prom. De Palma's approach to the material was lighter and more deft than my own and a good deal more artistic. The book tries to deal with the loneliness of one girl, her desperate effort to become a part of the peer society in which she must exist, and how her effort fails. If it had any thesis to offer, this deliberate updating of High School Confidential, it was that high school is a place of almost bottomless conservatism and bigotry, a place where the adolescents who attend are no more allowed to rise above their station than a Hindu would be allowed to rise above his or her caste. But there's a little more subtext to the book than that, I think. At least I hope so. If The Stepford Wives concerns itself with what men want from women, then Carrie is largely about how women find their own channels of power and what men fear about women and women's sexuality. Which is only to say that writing the book in 1973 and only out of college 3 years, I was fully aware of what women's liberation implied for me and others of my sex. The book is, in its more adult implications, an uneasy masculine shrinking from a future of female equality. For me, Carrie White is a sadly misused teenager, an example of the sort of person whose spirit is so often broken for good in that pit of man and woman eaters that is your normal suburban high school. But she's also a woman, feeling her powers for the first time and, like Samson, pulling down the temple on everyone in sight at the end of the book. Heavy, turgid stuff. But in the novel, it's only there if you want to take it. If you don't, that's okay with me. A subtext only works well if it's unobtrusive. In that, I perhaps succeeded too well. In her review of De Palma's film, Pauline Kael dismissed my novel as an unassuming potboiler. As depressing a description as one could imagine, but not completely inaccurate. De Palma's film is up to more ambitious things. As in The Stepford Wives, humor and horror exist side by side in Carrie, playing off one another. And it is only as the film nears its conclusion that horror takes over completely. We see Billy Nolan, well played by John Travolta, giving the cops a big "aw shucks" grin as he hides a beer against his crotch early on. It is a moment reminiscent of American Graffiti. Not long after, however, we see him swinging a sledgehammer at the head of a pig in a stockyard. The "aw shucks" grin has crossed the line into madness somehow, and that line crossing is what the film as a whole is about. We see three boys, one of them the film's nominal hero, played by William Catt, trying on tuxedos for the prom in a kind of gashouse kids routine that includes Donald Duck talk and speeded-up action. We see the girls who have humiliated Carrie in the shower room by throwing tampons and sanitary napkins at her, doing penance on the exercise field to tootling lumbering music, which is reminiscent of Baby Elephant Walk. And yet, beyond all these sophomoric and mildly amusing high school cut-ups, we sense a vacuous, almost unfocused hate, the almost unplanned revenge upon a girl who is trying to rise above her station. Much of De Palma's film is surprisingly jolly, but we sense his jocoseness is dangerous. Behind it lurks the "aw shucks" grin becoming a frozen rictus, and the girls laboring over their calisthenics were the same girls shouting, "Plug it up! Plug it up! Plug it up!" at Carrie not long before. Most of all, there is that bucket of pig's blood poised on the beam above the place where Carrie and Tommy, Cat, will eventually be crowned, only waiting its time. De Palma is sly and extremely adept at handling his mostly female cast. In writing the novel, I found myself slogging grimly toward the conclusion, trying to do the best job I could with what I knew about women, which was not a great deal. The strain shows in the finished book. It's a fast and entertaining read, I think, and for me at least, quite gripping. But there's a certain heaviness there that a really good popular novel should not have, a feeling of Sturm und Drang that I could not get rid of no matter how hard I tried. The book seems clear enough and truthful enough in terms of the characters and their actions, but it lacks the style of De Palma's film. The book attempts to look at the ant farm of high school society dead on. De Palma's examination of this high school confidential world is more oblique and more cutting. The film came along at a time when movie critics were bewailing the fact that there were no movies being made with good, meaty roles for women in them. But none of these critics seem to have noticed that in its film incarnation, Carrie belongs almost entirely to the ladies. Billy Nolan, a major and frightening character in the book, has been reduced to a semi-supporting role in the movie. Tommy, the boy who takes Carrie to the prom, is presented in the novel as a boy who is honestly trying to do something manly. In his own way, he is trying to opt out of the caste system. In the film, he becomes little more than his girlfriend's cat's paw, her tool of atonement for her part in the shower room scene where Carrie is pelted with sanitary napkins. "I don't go around with anyone I don't want to," Tommy said patiently. "I'm asking because I want to ask you." Ultimately, he knew this to be the truth. In the film, however, when Carrie asks Tommy why he is favoring her with an invitation to the prom, he offers her a dizzy sun-and-surf grin and says, "Because you liked my poem." which, by the way, his girlfriend wrote. The novel views high school in a fairly common way, as that pit of man and woman eaters already mentioned. De Palma's social stance is more original. He sees this suburban white kid's high school as a kind of matriarchy. No matter where you look, there are girls behind the scenes, pulling invisible wires, rigging elections, using their boyfriends as stalking horses. Against such a backdrop, Carrie becomes doubly pitiful, because she is unable to do any of these things. She can only wait to be saved or damned by the actions of others. Her only power is her telekinetic ability, and both book and movie eventually arrive at the same point. Carrie uses her wild talent to pull down the whole rotten society. And one reason for the success of the story in both print and film, I think, lies in this. Carrie's revenge is something that any student, whoever had his gym shorts pulled down in phys ed or his glasses thumb-rubbed in study hall, could approve of. In Carrie's destruction of the gym and her destructive walk back home in the book, a sequence left out of the movie because of tight budgeting, we see a dream revolution of the socially downtrodden. 8. Once upon a time, there dwelt on the outskirts of a large forest a poor woodcutter with his wife and two children. The boy was called Hansel and the girl Gretel. He had always had little enough to live on, and once, when there was a great famine in the land, he couldn't even provide them with daily bread. One night, as he was tossing about in his bed, full of cares and worry, he sighed and said to his wife, "What's to become of us? How are we to support our poor children now that we have nothing more for ourselves?"
"I'll tell you what, husband," answered the woman. "Early tomorrow morning we'll take the children into the thickest part of the wood. There we shall light a fire for them and give them each a piece of bread. Then we'll go on to our work and leave them alone. They won't be able to find their way home, and we shall thus be rid of them."
From the Andrew Lang Fairy Tale Treasury, edited by Kerry Wilkins, New York, Avenel Books, 1979, page 91. Previous to now, we have been discussing horror movies with subtexts, which try to link real, if sometimes free-floating, anxieties to the nightmare fears of the horror film. But now, with this invocation from Hansel and Gretel, that most cautionary of nursery tales, let us put out even this dim light of rationality and discuss a few of those films whose effects go considerably deeper, past the rational and into those fears which seem universal. Here is where we cross into the taboo lands for sure, and it's best that I be frank with you up front. I think that we're all mentally ill. Those of us outside the asylums only hide it a little better, and maybe not all that much better after all. We've all known people who talk to themselves, people who sometimes squinch their faces into horrible grimaces when they believe no one is watching, people who have some hysterical fear of snakes, the dark, the tight place, the long drop, and, of course, those final worms and grubs that are waiting so patiently underground to play their part in the great Thanksgiving table of life. What once ate must eventually be eaten. When we pay our $4 or $5 and seat ourselves at 10th Row Center in a theater showing a horror movie, we are daring the nightmare. Why? Some of the reasons are simple and obvious. To show that we can, that we are not afraid, that we can ride this roller coaster, which is not to say that a really good horror movie may not surprise a scream out of us at some point, the way we may scream when the roller coaster twists through a complete 360 or plows through a lake at the bottom of the drop. And horror movies, like roller coasters, have always been the special province of the young. By the time one turns 40 or 50, one's appetite for double twists of 360-degree loops may be considerably depleted. As pointed out, we also go to reestablish our feelings of essential normality. The horror movie is innately conservative, even reactionary. Freda Jackson, as the horrible melting woman in Die, Monster, Die, confirms for us that no matter how far we may be removed from the beauty of a Robert Redford or a Diana Ross, we are still light years from true ugliness. And we go to have fun.
Ah, but this is where the ground starts to slope away, isn't it?
because this is a very peculiar sort of fun indeed. The fun comes from seeing others menaced, sometimes killed. One critic has suggested that if pro football has become the voyeur's version of combat, then the horror film has become the modern version of the public lynching. It is true that the mythic fairy tale horror film intends to take away the shades of gray, which is one reason why When a Stranger Calls doesn't work. The psycho, well and honestly played by Tony Beckley, is a poor schmuck beset by the miseries of his own psychoses. Our unwilling sympathy for him dilutes the film's success as surely as water dilutes scotch. It urges us to put away our more civilized and adult penchant for analysis and to become children again, seeing things in pure blacks and pure whites. It may be that horror movies provide psychic relief on this level, because this invitation to lapse into simplicity and even outright madness is extended so rarely. We are told we may allow our emotions a free rein, or no rein at all. If we are all insane, then all insanity becomes a matter of degree. If your insanity leads you to carve up women like Jack the Ripper or the Cleveland Torso Murderer, we clap you away in the funny farm. Except neither of those two amateur night surgeons were ever caught. If, on the other hand, your insanity leads you only to talk to yourself when you're under stress or to pick your nose on your morning bus, then you are left alone to go about your business, although it's doubtful that you will ever be invited to the best parties. The potential lyncher is in almost all of us. I exclude saints, past and present. But then most or all saints have been crazy in their own ways. And every now and then, he has to be let loose to scream and roll around on the grass. By God, I do believe I'm talking werewolf again. Our emotions and our fears form their own body, and we recognize that it demands its own exercise to maintain proper muscle tone. Certain of these emotional muscles are accepted, even exalted, in civilized society. They are, of course, the emotions which tend to maintain the status quo of civilization itself. Love, friendship, loyalty, kindness. These are all the emotions which we applaud, emotions which have been immortalized in the bad couplets of Hallmark cards and in the verses, I don't dare call it poetry, of Leonard Nimoy. When we exhibit these emotions, society showers us with positive reinforcement. We learn this even before we get out of diapers. When, as children, we hug our rotten little puke of a sister and give her a kiss, all the aunts and uncles smile and twit and cry, "Isn't he the sweetest little thing?" Such coveted treats as chocolate-covered graham crackers often follow. But if we deliberately slam the rotten little puke of a sister's fingers in the door, sanctions follow. Angry remonstrance from parents, aunts, and uncles. Instead of a chocolate-covered graham cracker, a spanking. But anti-civilization emotions don't go away, and they demand periodic exercise. We have such sick jokes as, "What's the difference between a truckload of bowling balls and a truckload of dead babies?" "You can't unload a truckload of bowling balls with a pitchfork." A joke, by the way, which I heard originally from a 10-year-old. Such a joke may surprise a laugh or a grin out of us even as we recoil, a possibility which confirms the thesis. If we share a brotherhood of man, then we also share an insanity of man, none of which is intended as a defense of either the sick joke or insanity, but merely as an explanation of why the best horror films, like the best fairy tales, managed to be reactionary, anarchistic, and revolutionary all at the same time. My agent, Kirby McCauley, likes to relate a scene from Andy Warhol's film Bad, and he relates it in the fond tones of the confirmed horror movie buff. A mother throws her baby from the window of a skyscraper. We cut away to the crowd below and hear a loud splat. Another mother leads her son through the crowd and up to the mess, which is obviously a watermelon with seeds removed, points to it and says, to the effect, "That's what will happen to you if you're bad." It's a sick joke, like the one about the truckload of dead babies, or the one about the babes in the woods, which we call Hansel and Gretel. The mythic horror movie, like the sick joke, has a dirty job to do. It deliberately appeals to all that is worst in us. It is morbidity unchained, our most base instincts let free, our nastiest fantasies realized. And it all happens, fittingly enough, in the dark. For these reasons, good liberals often shy away from horror films. For myself, I like to see the most aggressive of them, Dawn of the Dead, for instance, as lifting a trap door in the civilized forebrain and throwing a basket of raw meat to the hungry alligators swimming around in that subterranean river beneath. Why bother? Because it keeps them from getting out, man. It keeps them down there and me up here. It was Lennon and McCartney who said that all you need is love, and I would agree with that, as long as you keep the gators fed. 9. And now this word from the poet Kenneth Patchen. It comes from his small, clever book, But Even So. Come now, my child, if we were planning to harm you, do you think we'd be lurking here, beside the path, in the very darkest part of the forest? This is the mood which the best films of mythic fairy tale horror summon up in us, and it also suggests that below the level of simple aggression and simple morbidity, there is a final level where the horror movie does its most powerful work. And that is well for us, because without more, the human imagination would be a poor, degraded thing, in need of no more in the way of horror than such things as Last House on the Left and Friday the 13th. The horror movie is planning to harm us, all right, and that is exactly why it is lurking here in the very darkest part of the forest. At this most basic level, the horror film isn't fooling around. It wants to get you. Once it has reduced you to a level of childlike expectation and point of view, it will begin playing one or more of a very few simple harmonic melodies. The greatest limitation, and therefore the greatest challenge of the horror form, is its very strictness. The things that really scare people on a gut level can be reduced like fractions to an irreducible handful. And when that has finally happened, analyses such as those I've given in the foregoing pages become impossible. And even if analysis were possible, it would be irrelevant. One can point out a fact, and that must be the end of the matter. To try and go any further is as useless as trying to divide a prime number by 2 and come out even. But effect may be enough. There are films, like Browning's Freaks, that have the power to reduce us to jelly, to make us mutter or whimper to ourselves, "Please let it stop." They are those films which hold their spell over us in spite of all we can do, even including the recitation of that most magic spell-breaking incantation, "It's only a movie." And they can all be invoked with that wonderful fairy tale door opener, Once Upon a Time. So, before we proceed any further, here's a little quiz for you. Get a scrap of paper and something to write with and jot down your answers. 20 questions. Give yourself 5 points per question. And if you score below 70, you need to go back and do some postgraduate work in the real fright films, the ones that scare us just because they scare us. Ready? Okay. Name these films. 1. Once upon a time, the husband of the world's champion blind lady had to go away for a while to slay a dragon or something of that sort, and a wicked man named Harry Rote, who came from Scarsdale, came by to see her while her husband was gone. 2. Once upon a time, 3 babysitters went out on Halloween night, and only one of them was still alive come All Saints' Day. 3. Once upon a time, a lady who stole some money spent a not-so-enchanted evening at an out-of-the-way motel. Everything seemed pretty much okay, until the motel owner's mother came by. Mother did something very naughty. 4. Once upon a time, some bad people tampered with the oxygen line in one operating room of a major hospital, and a lot of people went to sleep for a long, long time, just like Snow White. Only these people never woke up. 5. Once upon a time, there was a sad girl who picked up men in bars, because when the men came home with her, she didn't feel so sad. Except one night, she picked up a man who was wearing a mask. Underneath the mask, he was the bogeyman. 6. Once upon a time, some brave explorers landed on another planet to see if someone needed help. Nobody did, but by the time they got going again, they discovered that they had picked up the bogeyman. 7. Once upon a time, a sad lady named Eleanor went on an adventure in an enchanted castle. In the enchanted castle, Lady Eleanor was not so sad because she found some new friends, except that the friends left and she stayed forever. 8. Once upon a time, a young man tried to bring a magic potion from another country to his own aboard a magic flying carpet. But he was caught before he could get on his magic carpet, and the bad people took away his magic potion and locked him in an evil dungeon. 9. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who looked sweet, but she was really very wicked. She locked the janitor up in his room and set his highly flammable bed of wood chips and excelsior on fire because he was mean to her. 10. Once upon a time, there were two little children, very much like Hansel and Gretel, in fact, and when their father died, their mommy married a wicked man who pretended to be very good. This wicked man had love tattooed on the fingers of one hand and hate tattooed on the fingers of the other. 11. Once upon a time, there was an American lady living in London whose sanity was under some question. She thought she saw a murder in the old boarded-up house next door. 12. Once upon a time, a lady and her brother went to put flowers on their mother's grave, and the brother, who liked to play mean tricks, scared her by saying, "They're coming to get you, Barbara." Except that it turned out they really were coming to get her. But they got him first. 13. Once upon a time, all the birds in the world got mad at the people and started to kill the people because the birds were under an evil spell. 14. Once upon a time, a crazy man with an axe started to chop up his family one by one in an old Irish house. When he chopped off the groundskeeper's head, it rolled right down into the family pool. Wasn't that funny? 15. Once upon a time, two sisters grew old together in an enchanted castle in the kingdom of Hollywood. Once, one of them had been famous in the kingdom of Hollywood, but that was long, long ago. The other one was stuck in a wheelchair. And do you know what happened? The sister who could walk served her paralyzed sister a dead rat for dinner. Wasn't that funny? 16. Once upon a time, there was a cemetery caretaker who discovered that if he put black pins into the vacant plots on his cemetery map, the people who owned those plots would die. But when he took out the black pins and put in white pins, do you know what happened? The movie turned into a big pile of shit. Wasn't that funny? 17. Once upon a time, a bad man stole the little princess and buried her alive. Or at least he said he did. 18. Once upon a time, there was a man who invented some magic eye drops, and he could use them to see through people's cards in Las Vegas and make lots of money. He could also see through girls' clothes at cocktail parties, which was maybe not such a nice thing to do. But wait a minute. This man kept seeing more and more and more. 19. Once upon a time, there was a lady who was saddled with Satan's child, and he knocked her over a gallery railing with his trike. What a mean thing to do! But lucky mommy! Because she died soon after, she didn't have to do the sequel. 20. Once upon a time, some friends went on a canoe trip down a magic river, and some bad men saw that they were having fun and decided to fix them for it. That was because the bad men didn't want those other fellows who came from the city to have a good time in their woods.
Okay, did you write down all of your answers? If you find you have four or more blanks, not even an educated guess to plug in there, you have been spending far too much time seeing quality films like Julia, Manhattan, and Breaking Away. And while you've been watching Woody Allen give his imitation of an ingrown hair, a liberal ingrown hair, of course, you missed some of the scariest films ever made. For the record, the answers are 1. Wait Until Dark. 2. Halloween. 3. Psycho. 4. Coma. 5. Looking for Mr. Goodbar. 6. Alien. 7. The Haunting. 8. Midnight Express. 9. The Bad Seed. 10. The Night of the Hunter. 11. Night Watch. 12. Night of the Living Dead. 13. The Birds. 14. Dementia 13. 15. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. 16. I Bury the Living. 17. Macabre. This William Castle feature, his first, but unfortunately not his last, was perhaps the biggest gutsy picture of my grammar school days. Its title was pronounced by my friends in Stratford, Connecticut as McBear. Gutsy or not, very few of our parents would let us go because of the grisly ad campaign. I, however, exercised the inventiveness of the true aficionado and got to see it by telling my mother I was going to Davy Crockett, a Disney film which I felt I could summarize safely because I had most of the bubblegum cards. 18. X. The Man with the X-Ray Eyes. 19. The Omen. 20. Deliverance. The first thing we can note about this list of films is that of the 20, which I would call the basic coursework in films of gut-level horror in the period we're discussing here, fully 14 have nothing supernatural going on in them. 15, if you count Alien, which is at least nominally science fiction. I do count it as a supernatural tale, however. I think of it as Lovecraft in outer space, mankind finally going to the elder gods, rather than they coming to us. So we might be able to say, paradox or not, that movies of fairy tale horror demand a heavy dose of reality to get them rolling. Such reality frees the imagination of excess baggage and makes the weight of unbelief easier to lift. The audience is propelled into the movie by the feeling that, under the right set of circumstances, this could happen. The second thing we could note is that a quarter of them bear a reference either to night or the dark in their titles. The dark, it goes almost without saying, provides the basis for our most primordial fears. As spiritual as we may believe our natures to be, our physiology is similar to that of all the rest of the mammals that creep, crawl, trot, or walk. We must make do with the same five senses. There are many mammals whose eyesight is keen, but we are not among them. There are mammals, dogs for instance, which have even lousier eyesight than we do, but their lack of brain power has forced them to develop other senses to a keenness we cannot even imagine, although we may think we can. With dogs, the overdeveloped senses are those of hearing and smell. So-called psychics like to prate of a sixth sense, a vague term which sometimes means telepathy, sometimes precognition, sometimes God knows what. But we have a sixth sense. It is probably just, the keenness of our reasoning facilities. Fido may be able to follow 100 scents of which we are completely unaware, but the little bugger is never going to be any good at checkers, or even go fish. This reasoning power has made it unnecessary for us to breed keener senses into the gene pool. In fact, a large part of the population has sensory equipment, which is actually substandard even by human standards. Hence, eyeglasses and hearing aids. But we are able to make do because of our Boeing 747 brains. All of which is very fine when you're doing a deal in a well-lit executive boardroom or ironing the laundry in the living room on a sunny afternoon. But when the lights fail during a thunderstorm and we're left to creep around from place to place trying to remember where we left the goddamn candles, the situation changes. Even a 747, sophisticated onboard radar and all, can't land in a heavy fog bank. When the lights go out and we find ourselves stranded in a shoal of darkness, reality itself has an unpleasant way of fogging in. When we cut off one avenue of sensory input, that sense simply shuts down. Although it never shuts down 100%, of course, even in a dark room we will see a trace pattern in front of our eyes, and in the most perfect silence we will hear a faint hum. Such phantom input only means that the circuits are open and standing by. The same does not happen with our brains, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the situation. It's fortunate if you happen to be stuck in a boring situation. You can use your sixth sense to plan the next day's work, to wonder what life might be like if you won the grand prize in the state lottery or the Reader's Digest sweepstakes, or to speculate on what that sexy Miss Heppelwaite does, or doesn't, wear under those tight dresses of hers. On the other hand, the brain's constant function can be a mixed blessing. Ask anyone who is a victim of chronic insomnia. I tell people who say that horror movies don't scare them to make this simple experiment. Go see a film like Night of the Living Dead all alone. Have you ever noticed how many people go to horror movies not just in pairs or groups, but in actual packs? Afterwards, get in your car, drive to an old, deserted, crumbling house. Every town has at least one, except Stepford, Connecticut, but they have their own problems there. Let yourself in. Mount to the attic. Sit down up there. Listen to the house groan and creak around you. Notice how much those creaks sound like someone, or something, mounting the stairs. Smell the must, the rot, the decay. Think about the film you have just seen. Consider it as you sit there in the dark, unable to see what might be creeping up, what might be just about to place its dirty, twisted claw on your shoulder or around your neck. This sort of thing can prove by its very darkness to be an enlightening experience. Fear of the dark is the most childlike fear. Tales of terror are customarily told around the campfire, or at least after sundown, because what is laughable in the sunshine is often tougher to smile at by starlight. This is a fact that every maker of horror films and writer of horror tales recognizes and uses. It is one of those unfailing pressure points where the grip of horror fiction is surest. Now and then someone will run brilliantly counter to the tradition and produce a piece of what is sometimes called sunlit horror. Ramsey Campbell does this particularly well. See his aptly named collection of short stories, Demons by Daylight, for instance. This is particularly true of the filmmakers, of course, and of all the tools that the filmmaker can bring to bear, it is perhaps this fear of the dark that seems the most natural, since movies must, by their very nature, be viewed in the dark. It was Michael Cantalupo, an assistant editor at Everest House, who reminded me of a gimmick used in the first-run engagements of Wait Until Dark, and in this context, it bears an affectionate mention. The last 15 or 20 minutes of that film are utterly terrifying, partially due to virtuoso performances turned in by Audrey Hepburn and Alan Arkin, and in my view, Arkin's performance as Harry Rote Jr. from Scarsdale may be the greatest evocation of screen villainy ever, rivaling and perhaps surpassing Peter Lorre's in M. Partially due to the brilliant gimmick on which Frederick Knott's story turns. Hepburn, in a final desperate effort to save her life, breaks every damned light bulb in the apartment and hallway, so that she and the sighted Arkin will be on even terms. Trouble is, she forgets one light. But you and I probably would have forgotten it too. It's the bulb inside the refrigerator. Anyway, the in-theater gimmick was to turn out every damn light in the auditorium except for the exit lights over the doors. I never realized until the last 10 minutes of Wait Until Dark how much light there is in most theaters, even when the movie's playing. There are those tiny dim bulbs set into the ceiling of the theater as one of the new breed, those gauche but somehow lovely electric flambeaux glowing along the walls and the older ones. In a pinch, you can always find your way back to your seat after using the bathroom by the light being thrown from the screen itself. Except that the climactic few minutes of Wait Until Dark are set entirely in that black apartment. You have only your ears and what they hear, Miss Hepburn screaming, Arkin's tortured breathing. He's been stabbed a bit earlier on and we're allowed to relax a little, to think he might even be dead, when he pops out again like a malefic jack-in-the-box, isn't very comforting. So there you sit. Your big old Boeing 747 brain is cranked up like a kid's jalopy with a pedal to the metal, and it has very little concrete input to work on. So you sit there, sweating it out, hoping the lights will eventually come on again. Sooner or later, they do. Mike Canalupo told me he saw Wait Until Dark in a theater so sleazy that even the exit lights were broken. Man, that must have been bad. Mike's recollection of that took me fondly back to another film, William Castle's The Tingler, which had a similar, if in the Castle style infinitely more crass, gimmick. Castle, whom I've already mentioned in connection with Macabre, known to all us waspy little kids as McBear, you'll remember, was the king of the gimmicks. He originated the $100,000 fright insurance policy, for instance. If you dropped dead during the film, your heirs got the money. Then there was the great nurse on duty at all performances gimmick. There was the you must have your blood pressure taken in the lobby before viewing this horrifying film gimmick. That one was used as part of the House on the Haunted Hill promo, and all sorts of other gimmicks. The exact plot specifics of The Tingler, a film so exquisitely low budget that it probably made back its production costs after 1,000 people had seen it, now escape me, but there was this monster, The Tingler, Natch, that lived on fear. When its victims were so scared they couldn't even scream, it attached itself to their spines and sort of, well, tingled them to death. I know that must sound pretty fucking stupid, but in the film it worked, although it probably helped to be 11 years old when you saw it. As I remember, one sexy miss got in the bathtub. Bad news. But never mind the plot, let's get on to the gimmick. At one point, the Tingler got into a movie theater, killed the projectionist, and somehow shorted out the electricity. At that moment in the theater where you were watching the movie, all the lights went out and the screen went dark. Now, as it happened, the only thing that could get the Tingler to let go of your spine, once it had attached itself, was a good, loud scream, which changed the quality of the adrenaline it fed on. And at this point, a narrator on the soundtrack cried out, "The Tingler is now in this theater. It may be under your seat. So scream, scream, scream for your lives!" The audience was, of course, happy to oblige, and in the next scene we see the Tingler fleeing for its life, vanquished for the time being by all those screaming people. Nor was that all. According to Dennis Etchison, there was yet another gimmick used by Castle during the Tingler's first run, in showcase theaters only. Certain rows of these theaters, Dennis says, were wired with buzzing devices attached to the backs or bottoms of the seats, so at the appropriate moment you could hear and feel the Tingler in your row. God, it's fun to think about some of the desperate gimmicks that have been used to sell bad horror movies, like those dish nights and bank nights used to lure people into the movie houses during the 30s. They linger pleasantly in the memory. During one imported Italian turkey, The Night Evelyn Came Out of the Grave, nifty title, the theaters advertised blood corn, which was ordinary popcorn with a red food dye added. During Jack the Ripper, a 1960 example of Hammer-style horror written by Jimmy Sangster, the black-and-white film turned to gruesome color during the last 5 minutes when the Ripper, who is unwisely chosen to hide in an elevator shaft, is squished under a descending car. Besides the movies, which raised the scary concept of dark in their titles, almost every other film listed in the little quiz I gave you uses that fear of the dark heavily. All but approximately 18 minutes of John Carpenter's Halloween are set after nightfall. In Looking for Mr. Goodbar, the final horrible sequence, my wife ran for the women's room, believing she was going to toss her cookies, where Tom Berenger stabs Diane Keaton to death, is shot in her dark apartment, with only a flickering strobe light for illumination. In Alien, that constant motif of the dark barely needs mentioning. "In space, no one can hear you scream," the ad copy read. It also could have said, "In space, it is always 1 minute after midnight." Dawn never comes in that Lovecraftian gulf between the stars. Hill House is always spooky, but it saves its really big effects. The face in the wall, the bulging doors, the booming noises, the thing that held Eleanor's hand. She thought it was Theo, but gulp, it wasn't. for well past sunset. It was another Everest House editor, Bill Thompson, who has been my editor for about 1,000 years. Perhaps in a previous life I was his editor, and now he's having his revenge. Who reminded me of the Night of the Hunter, and mea culpa that I should have needed reminding, and told me that one of the scenes of horror which has remained with him over the years was the sight of Shelley Winter's hair floating in the water after the homicidal preacher has disposed of her in the river. It happens, naturally, after dark. Dennis Etchison disputes Bill Thompson's memory. He says it happens in daytime, else Shelley Winters would not have been visible or photographable at the bottom of that river. This raises the interesting idea that we make the dark in our memories. There is an interesting similarity between the scene in which the little girl kills her mother with a garden trowel in Night of the Living Dead and the climactic scene in The Birds, where Tippi Hedren is trapped in the attic and attacked by crows, sparrows, and gulls. Both of these scenes are classic examples of how dark and light can be used selectively. We will remember, most of us, from our own childhoods, that a lot of light had the power to vanquish imagined evils and fears, but sometimes a little light only made them worse. It was the streetlight outside that made the branches of a nearby tree look like witch fingers, or it was the moonlight streaming in the window that made the jumble of toys pushed away in the closet take on the aspect of a crouching thing ready to shamble in and attack at any moment. During the matricide scene in Night of the Living Dead, which, like the shower scene in Psycho, seems almost endless to our shocked eyes the first time we see it, the little girl's arm strikes a hanging light bulb, and the cellar becomes a nightmare dreamscape of shifting, swinging shadows, revealing, concealing, revealing again. During the attack of the birds in the attic, it is the big flashlight Miss Hedren carries which provides the strobe effect, also mentioned in connection with Looking for Mr. Goodbar and used again, more irritatingly and pointlessly, during Marlon Brando's incoherent monologue near the end of Apocalypse Now, and also provides the scene with a pulse, a beat. At first, the flashlight beam moves rapidly as Miss Hedren uses the light to ward off the birds, but as she is gradually sapped of strength and lapses first into shock and then into unconsciousness, the light moves more and more slowly, sinking to the floor, until there is only dark, and in that dark, the tenebrous, whirring flutter of many wings. I will not belabor the point by analyzing the darkness quotient in all these films, but will close this aspect of the discussion by pointing out that even in those few movies that achieve that feeling of sunlit horror, there are often fiery moments in the dark. Genevieve Bujold's climb up the service ladder and over the operating room in coma takes place in the dark, as does Ed's John Voight climb up the bluff near the end of Deliverance, not to mention digging up the grave containing the jackal bones in The Omen, and Luana Anders's creepy discovery of the underwater memorial to the long-dead little sister in Francis Coppola's first feature film, made for AIP, Dementia 13. Still, before leaving the subject entirely, here's a further sampling. Night Must Fall, Night of the Lepus, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, The Black Pit of Dr. M., The Black Sleep, Black Sunday, The Black Room, Black Sabbath, Dark Eyes of London, The Dark, Dead of Night, Night of Terror, Night of the Demon, Night Wing, Night of the Eagle. Well, you get it. If there had been no such thing as darkness, the makers of horror movies would have needed to invent it. 10. I have held out mention of one of the films from the quiz, partially because it's the antithesis of many of those we've already discussed. It depends for its horror not upon darkness, but upon light, and also because it leads naturally into a brief discussion of something else that the mythic or fairy tale horror movie will do to us if it can. We all understand about the gross out, which is fairly easy to achieve. I can remember, as a kid, one of my fellow kids asking me to imagine sliding down a long, polished banister which suddenly and without warning turns into a razor blade. Man, I was dazed getting over that. But it is only in the horror movies that the gross out, that most childish of emotional impulses, sometimes achieves the level of art. Now, I can hear some of you say that there is nothing artistic about grossing somebody out. All you really have to do is chew your food and then hang your open mouth in your table mate's face. But what about the works of Goya, or Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes and soup cans, for that matter? Even the very worst horror movies sometimes achieve a moment or two of success on this level. Dennis Etchison reminisced fondly with me on the phone one day, not too long ago, about a brief sequence in The Giant Spider Invasion where a lady drinks her morning high-potency vitamin cocktail, all unknowing that a rather plump spider fell into the blender just before she turned it on. Yum, yum. In the eminently forgettable film Squirm, there is that one forgettable moment, for all 200 of us who saw the picture, when the lady taking a shower looks up to see why the water stopped coming and sees a showerhead clogged with dangling nightcrawlers. In Dario Argento's Suspiria, a bunch of schoolgirls are subjected to a rain of maggots, while getting ready for bed, no less. All of it has nothing to do with the film's plot, but it is vaguely interesting in a repulsive sort of way. In Maniac, directed by former softcore filmmaker William Lustig, there is the incredible moment when the homicidal ding-dong, Joe Spinell, carefully scalps one of his victims. The camera does not even leer at this. It merely stares at it with a kind of dead, contemplative eye that makes the scene well-nigh impossible to watch. As noted previously, good horror movies often operate most powerfully on this "wanna look at my chewed-up food" level, a primitive, childish level. I would call it the yuck factor, sometimes also known as the "oh my god, was that gross" factor. This is the point at which most good liberal film critics and most good reactionary film critics part company on the subject of the horror film. See, for instance, the difference between Lynn Minton's review of Dawn of the Dead and McCall's, she left after two reels or so, and the cover story in the arts section of the Boston Phoenix on the same film. Like punk rock music, the horror movie capable of delivering the good gross-out wallop finds its art in childish acts of anarchy. The moment in The Omen, where the photographer is decapitated by a pane of glass, is art of the most peculiar sort, and one cannot blame critics who find it easier to respond to Jane Fonda as a wholly unbelievable screen incarnation of Lillian Hellman in Julia than to stuff like this. But the gross-out is art, and it is important that we have an understanding of this. Blood can fly everywhere, and the audience will remain largely unimpressed if, on the other hand, the audience has come to like and understand, or even just to appreciate, the characters they are watching as real people. If some artistic link has been formed there, blood can fly everywhere and the audience cannot remain unimpressed. I can't remember, for instance, anyone who walked out of Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde or Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch who didn't look as if he or she hadn't been hit on the head with a very large board. Yet people walk out of other Peckinpah films, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, Cross of Iron, yawning. That vital linkage just never happens. That's all fine, and there is little argument about the virtues of Bonnie and Clyde as art, but let us return momentarily to the pureed arachnid and the giant spider invasion. This doesn't qualify as art in respect to that idea of linkage between audience and character at all. Believe me, we don't care very much about the lady who drinks the spider, or anyone else in this movie for that matter. But all the same, there is that moment of frisson, that one moment when the groping fingers of the filmmaker find a chink in our defenses, shoot through it, and squeeze down on one of those psychic pressure points. We identify with the woman who is unknowingly drinking the spider on a level that has nothing to do with her character. We identify with her solely as a human being in a situation which has suddenly turned rotten. In other words, the gross-out serves as the means of a last-ditch sort of identification when the more conventional and noble means of characterization have failed. When she drinks the drink, we shudder and reaffirm our own humanity. This might lead to the accusation that my definition of the horror movie as art is much too wide, that I just let in everything. That is not true at all. Movies like Massacre at Central High and Bloody Mutilators work on no level. And if my ideas concerning the boundaries of art seem rather lenient, that's too bad. I'm no snob, and if you are, that's your problem. In my business, if you lose your taste for good bologna, it's time you got into some other line of work. Having said all that, let's turn to X, the man with the X-ray eyes, one of the most interesting and offbeat little horror movies ever made, and one that ends with one of the most shuddery gross-out scenes ever filmed. This 1963 movie was produced and directed by Roger Corman, who at that time was in the process of metamorphosing from the dull caterpillar who had produced such meatloaf movies as Attack of the Crab Monsters and The Little Shop of Horrors, not even notable for what was one of Jack Nicholson's earliest films, and into the butterfly who was responsible for such interesting and rather beautiful horror films as The Mask of the Red Death and The Terror. The Man with the X-ray Eyes marks the point where this strange two-step creature came out of its cocoon, I think. The screenplay was written by Ray Russell, the author of Sardonicus, and a number of other stories and novels, among them the rather overripe Incubus and the much more successful Princess Pamela. In The Man with the X-ray Eyes, Ray Milland plays a scientist who develops eye drops which enable him to see through walls, clothing, playing cards, you name it. A kind of supermurine, if you will. But once the process begins, there is no slowing it down. Milland's eyes begin to undergo a physical change, first becoming thickly bloodshot, and then taking on a queer yellow cast. It is at this point that we begin to feel rather nervous. Perhaps we sense the gross-out coming, and in a very real sense, it's already arrived. Our eyes are one of those vulnerable chinks in the armor, one of those places where we can be had. Imagine, for instance, jamming your thumb into someone's wide-open eye, feeling the squish, seeing it sort of squirt out at you. Nasty, right? Immoral to even consider such a thing. But surely you remember that time-honored Halloween party game, Dead Man, where peeled grapes are passed from hand to hand to hand in the dark to the solemn intonation of, "These are the dead man's eyes."
Oop, right? Yuck, right?
Or as my kids say, gross. Like our other facial equipment, eyes are something we all have in common. Even that old poop the Ayatollah Khomeini had a pair. But to the best of my knowledge, no horror movie has ever been made about a nose out of control. And while there has never been a film called The Crawling Ear, there was one called The Crawling Eye. We all understand that eyes are the most vulnerable of our sensory organs, the most vulnerable of our facial accessories, and they are, ick, soft. Maybe that's the worst. So when Milland dons shades for the second half of the movie, we become increasingly nervous about what might be going on behind those shades. In addition, something else is happening. Something that elevates The Man with the X-ray Eyes to a rather higher plateau of art. It becomes a kind of Lovecraftian horror movie, but in a sense that is different and somehow purer than the sort of Lovecraftiness used in Alien. The elder gods, Lovecraft told us, are out there, and their one desire is to somehow get back in. And there are lines of power accessible to them, Lovecraft intimates, which are so powerful that one look at the sources of these lines of power would drive mortal men to madness, forces so powerful that a whole galaxy aflame could not equal its thousandth part. It is one of these power sources, I think, that Ray Milland begins to glimpse as his sight continues to improve at a steady, inexorable pace. He sees it first as a prismatic shifting light somewhere out in the darkness, the trippy sort of thing you might see at the top of an LSD high. Corman, you'll remember, also gave us Peter Fonda in The Trip, co-written by Jack Nicholson, not to mention The Wild Angels, which contains that wonderful moment when a dying Bruce Dern croaks out, "Somebody give me a straight cigarette." Anyway, this bright core of light Milland sometimes sees gradually grows larger and clearer. Worse still, it may be alive and aware it's being watched. Milland has seen through everything to the very edges of the universe and beyond, and what he has found there is driving him crazy. This force eventually becomes so clear to him that it fills the whole screen during the point-of-view shots, a bright, shifting, monstrous thing that won't quite come into focus. At last, Moland can stand it no longer. He drives his car to a deserted spot, that bright presence hanging before his eyes all the time, and whips off his shades to reveal eyes which have gone an utter glistening black. He pauses for a moment, and then rips his own eyes out. Corman freezes the frame on those staring, bloody sockets. But I have heard rumors, they may or may not be true, that the final line of dialogue was cut from the film as too horrifying. If true, it was the only possible capper for what has already happened. According to the rumor, Moland screams, "I can still see!" 11. This is only to dip our fingers in that deep, deep pool of common human experience and fears which form the myth pool. It would be possible to go on with dozens of other specifics, with phobias such as the fear of heights, vertigo, fear of snakes, of cats, eye of the cat, of rats, Willard, Ben, and all those movies which depend on the gross-out for their ultimate effect. Beyond these, there are even wider vistas of myth, but we have to save something for later, right? And no matter how many specifics we cover, we'll always find ourselves returning to that idea of phobic pressure points, just as the most lovely waltz relies, at bottom, on the simplicity of the box step. The horror movie is a closed box with a crank on the side, and in the last analysis, it all comes back to turning that crank until Jack jumps out into our faces, holding his axe and grinning his murderous grin. Like sex, the experience is infinitely desirable, but a discussion of specific effect takes on a certain sameness. Rather than going on and on over what is essentially the same plot of ground, let's close our brief discussion of the horror movie as myth and fairy tale with what is, after all, the big casino, death itself. Here is the trump card which all horror movies hold. But they do not hold this card as a veteran bridge player would hold it, understanding all its implications and possibilities for gain. They hold it, rather, as a child would hold a card, which will make the winning pair in a game of old maid. In that fact lies both the limiting factor of the horror movie as art and its endless, morbidly captivating charm. Death, the boy Mark Petrie thinks at one point in Salem's Lot, is when the monsters get you. And if I had to restrict everything I have ever said or written about the horror genre to one statement, and many critics will say I should have done, ha ha, it would be that one. It is not the way adults look at death. It is a crude metaphor which leaves little room for the possibility of heaven, hell, nirvana, or that old wheeze about how the great wheel of karma turns and we'll get 'em next life, gang. It is a view which, like most horror movies, addresses itself not to any philosophical speculation about the afterlife, but which speaks only of the moment when we finally have to shuffle off this mortal coil. That instant of death is the only truly universal rite of passage, and the only one for which we have no psychological or sociological input to explain what changes we may expect as a result of having passed through. All we know is that we go. And while we have some rules of etiquette, would it be called, which bear on the subject, that actual moment has a way of catching folks unprepared. People pass away while making love, while standing in elevators, while putting dimes in parking meters. Some go in mid-sneeze, some die in restaurants, some in cheap one-night hotels, and a few while sitting on the john. We cannot count on dying in bed or with our boots on. So it would be remarkable indeed if we did not fear death a little. It's just sort of there, isn't it? The great irreducible X-factor of our lives. Faceless father of 100 religions, so seamless and ungraspable that it usually isn't even discussed at cocktail parties. Death becomes myth in the horror movies, but let's be clear on the fact that horror movies mythicize death on the simplest level. Death in the horror movies is when the monsters get you.
We fans of the horror movies have seen people clubbed, burned at the stake. Vincent Price as the Witchfinder General in AIP's The Conqueror Worm, surely one of the most revolting horror pictures to be released by a major studio in the 60s, had a regular cookout at the climax of this one. Shot, crucified, stabbed through the eyes with needles, eaten alive by grasshoppers, by ants, by dinosaurs, and even by cockroaches, we have seen people beheaded, The Omen, Friday the 13th, Maniac, sucked dry of their blood, gobbled up by sharks. Who could forget the little kid's torn and blood-stained rubber float nudging gently against the shoreline in Jaws? And piranha fish. We have seen bad guys go down screaming in pools of quicksand and pools of acid. We have seen our fellow humans squashed, stretched, and bloated to death. At the end of Brian De Palma's The Fury, John Cassavetes literally explodes. Again, liberal critics, whose concepts of civilization, life, and death are usually more complex, are apt to frown on this sort of gratuitous slaughter, to see it, at best, as the moral equivalent of pulling wings off flies, and at worst, as that symbolic lynch mob in action. But there is something in that wing-pulling simile that bears examination. There are few children who have not pulled the wings off a few flies at some point in their development, or squatted patiently on the sidewalk to see how a bug dies. In the opening scene of The Wild Bunch, a group of happy, giggling children burn a scorpion to death, a scene indicative of what people who care little or know little about children often erroneously call the cruelty of childhood. Children are rarely cruel on purpose, and they even more rarely torture as they understand the concept. From Kids, Day In and Day Out, edited by Elizabeth Charlotte, New York, Simon & Schuster, 1979. This particular story related by Walter Gerald. They may, however, kill in the spirit of experimentation, watching the death struggle of the bug on the sidewalk in the same clinical way that a biologist would watch a guinea pig die after inhaling a whiff of nerve gas. Tom Sawyer, we'll remember, just about broke his neck in his hurry to get a look at Huck's dead cat, and one of the payments he accepts for the privilege of whitewashing his fence is a dead rat and a string to swing it on. Or consider this. Bing Crosby is said to have told a story about one of his sons at the age of 6 or so who was inconsolable when his pet turtle died. To distract the boy, Bing suggested that they have a funeral, and his son, seeming only slightly consoled, agreed. The two took a cigar box, lined it carefully with silk, painted the outside black, and then dug a hole in the backyard. Bing carefully lowered the coffin into the grave, said a long, heartfelt prayer, and sang a hymn. At the end of the service, the boy's eyes were shining with sorrow and excitement. Then Bing asked if he would like to have one last look at his pet before they covered the coffin with earth. The boy said he would, and Bing raised the cigar box lid. The two gazed down reverently, and suddenly the turtle moved. The boy stared at it for a long time, then looked up at his father and said, "Let's kill it." Now, don't get me wrong or misinterpret what I'm saying. Kids can be mean and unlovely, and when you see them at their worst, they can make you think black thoughts about the future of the human race. But meanness and cruelty, although related, are not the same thing at all. A cruel action is a studied action. It requires a bit of thought. Meanness, on the other hand, is unpremeditated and unthinking. The results may be similar for the person, usually another child who gets the butt end, but it seems to me that in a moral society, intent, or lack of it, is pretty important. Kids are endlessly, voraciously curious, not only about death, but about everything. And why not? They are like people who just came in and sat down during a good movie that's been on for thousands of years. They want to know what the story is, who the characters are, and most of all, what the interior logic of the play may be. Is it a drama? A tragedy? A comedy? Perhaps an out-and-out farce? They don't know because they have not, as yet, had Socrates, Plato, Kant, or Eric Siegel to instruct them. When you're 5, your big gurus are Santa Claus and Ronald McDonald. Life's burning questions include whether or not you can eat crackers upside down,
and if that stuff in the middle of the golf ball really is a deadly poison. When you're five, you seek knowledge down those avenues that are open to you. Pursuant to this, I'll tell you my own dead cat story. When I was 9 and living in Stratford, Connecticut, 2 friends of mine, brothers from down the street, discovered the stiffening body of a dead cat in the gutter near Burritt's Building Materials, which was across the street from the vacant lot where we played baseball. I was called into consultation to add my thoughts to the problem of the dead cat, the very interesting problem of the dead cat. It was a gray cat, quite obviously mashed by a passing car. Its eyes were half open, and we all noticed that there seemed to be dust and road grit gathering on them. First deduction: you don't care if dust gets in your eyes when you're dead. All our deductions assumed that if it was true for cats, then it must be true for kids. We examined it for maggots. No maggots. Maybe there's maggots inside it, Charlie said hopefully. Charlie was one of the fellows who referred to the William Castle film as McBear, and on rainy days he was apt to call me up and ask me if I wanted to come down the street to his house and read Comet Boots. We examined the dead cat for maggots, turning it from one side to the other, using a stick, of course. No telling what germs you might get from a dead cat. There were no maggots that we could see. Maybe there's maggots in his brain, Charlie's brother Nicky said, his eyes glowing. Maybe there's maggots inside it, eating up its brain. That's impossible, I said. Your brains are like airtight. Nothing can get inside there. They absorbed this. We stood around the dead cat in a circle. Then Nicky said suddenly, if we drop a brick on his hiney, will it shit? This question of postmortem biology was absorbed and discussed. It was finally agreed that the test should be made. A brick was found. There was a discussion of who should get to bombs away the brick on the dead cat. The problem was solved in time-honored fashion. We put our feet in. The rights of eeny, meeny, miny, mo were invoked. Foot after foot left the circle until only Nicky's was left. The brick was dropped. The dead cat did not shit. Deduction number 2. After you're dead, you won't shit if someone drops a brick on your ass. Soon after, a baseball game started up, and the dead cat was left. As the days passed, an ongoing investigation of the cat continued, and it is always the dead cat in the gutter out in front of Barrett's Building Materials that I think of when I read Richard Wilbur's fine poem, The Groundhog. The maggots put in their appearance a couple of days later, and we watched their fever boil with horrified, revolted interest. They're eating his eyes, Tommy Erbter from up the street pointed out hoarsely. Look at that, you guys. They're even eating his eyes. Eventually, the maggots moved out, leaving the dead cat looking considerably thinner, its fur now faded to a dull, uninteresting color, sparse and knotted. We came less frequently. The cat's decay had entered a less gaudy stage. Still, it was my habit to check the cat on my mile's walk to school each morning. It was just another stop on the way, part of the morning's ritual, like running a stick over the picket fence in front of the empty house, or skipping a couple of stones across the pond in the park. In late September, the tag end of a hurricane hit Stratford. There was a minor flood, and when the waters went down a couple of days later, the dead cat was gone. It had been washed away. I remember it well now, and I suppose I will all my life, as my first intimate experience with death. That cat may be gone from the charts, but not from my heart. Sophisticated movies demand sophisticated reactions from their audiences. That is, they demand that we react to them as adults. Horror movies are not sophisticated, and because they are not, they allow us to regain our childish perspective on death. Perhaps not such a bad thing. I'll not descend to the romantic oversimplification that suggests we see things more clearly as children, but I will suggest that children see more intensely. The greens of lawns are, to the child's eyes, the color of lost emeralds in H. Rider Haggard's conception of King Solomon's mines. The blue of the winter sky is as sharp as an ice pick. The white of new snow is a dream blast of energy. And black is blacker. Much blacker indeed.
Here is the final truth of horror movies. They do not love death, as some have suggested. They love life. They do not celebrate deformity, but by dwelling on deformity, they sing of health and energy. By showing us the miseries of the damned, they help us to rediscover the smaller, but never petty, joys of our own lives. They are the barber's leeches of the psyche, drawing not bad blood, but anxiety. For a little while, anyway. The horror movie asks you if you want to take a good close look at the dead cat, or the shape under the sheet, to use a metaphor from the introduction to my short story collection, but not as an adult would look at it. Never mind the philosophical implications of death or the religious possibilities inherent in the idea of survival, the horror film suggests we just have a good close look at the physical artifact of death. Let us be children masquerading as pathologists. We will, perhaps, link hands like children in a circle and sing the song we all know in our hearts. Time is short. No one is really okay. Life is quick, and dead is dead. Omega, the horror film sings in those children's voices, here is the end. Yet the ultimate subtext that underlies all good horror films is, but not yet, not this time. Because in the final sense, the horror movie is the celebration of those who feel they can examine death because it does not yet live in their own hearts.